the city square as the locus of urban democracy.
The square is not about the architecture. I think that architecture can certainly enhance the square. It's important, but the architecture is there to serve the people who come. It's a backdrop for the people, and the people form the square.
That's Katie Marin. We talk with her about the book she edited, a compilation of 18 essays by an eclectic assortment of wonderful writers. It's called City Squares. We also re-air our 2015 interview with urban philosopher David Kishik. His book is The Manhattan Project. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. We live in a unique period of human history and in the history of urbanism. More than half of the global population now lives in cities, and at the heart of many of those cities lie the public spaces we call squares, even though most of them are not even in the shape of a square. What they all share is that they're gathering places for the people, great democratic spaces where we come to be together. On an ordinary day, that might just mean having lunch on a bench with other city residents. But on other days, it may mean coming together in common mourning, as in New York City's Union Square after 9/11. Or it may mean a place where revolutions are born and sometimes die. Think Tahrir Square in Cairo in 2012, or Tiananmen Square in Beijing in 1989. The city square may take on different identities at different times in history, or even in the course of one day, perhaps being a market by day and a place for lovers to stroll by night. In the new book she edited called City Squares, Katie Marin brings 18 wonderful writers together to explore the spirit and significance of squares around the world. Contributors include Adam Gopnik on the Place des Vosges, Jahani Nochayam on Tahrir Square, and Rory Stewart on a square in Kabul that kept on trying not to be a square in spite of his efforts. The book also has essays by David Remnick and Michael Kimmelman on squares as expressions of the soul of a people. Katie Marin's first book was about city parks, and she was instrumental in the creation of one of New York's newest and most notable parks, the citizen-initiated High Line. Well, Katie Marin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much, Francesca.
This wonderful book, City Squares, talks about the square, the public square, in just a marvelous way. You have a whole bunch of different essays by some wonderful writers. And right up in the beginning, in the introduction, you call the public square the one essential urban space, deeply free and democratic. Say more about that. Why is it the one essential urban space, and what makes it deeply free?
Obviously, it's open to everybody. It's open space. And as you think about cities today, or really any time, so much of a city is private. It's behind closed doors. It is inaccessible. But this is the place where people can come together. And in all of my research, I have learned, first and foremost, how important it is just to human nature to have a spot to come together. And when you think of the square, the reason I say it's essential is that it has stood the test of time pretty much better than anything, and has been around since the agora of ancient Greece, well over 2,000 years.
Right. And what was so interesting to me about Michael Kimmelman's essay in the book, in the beginning of the book, is that he talked about that first square, the agora, as being almost the definition of democratic politics, or something that defined, it was a space for that early Greek invention of democracy.
Yes, and I understand that the Greeks held the concept on the square of the square as a pedestal. It was the public center of a city, and the Greeks went as far as to think that if there was no square in a town or a city, it really didn't count as a town or a city. It was that important. They started as marketplaces. Many squares have started as marketplaces, a place for people to negotiate face-to-face. And it symbolized at the time civil justice because it mixed religion, politics, commerce. It was all there in that space.
Civil justice.
Yes. That's exactly what Michael calls it. And civil justice, by that, I gather he means the ability to do whatever you want somewhere. Mm. In fact, he comments in his essay that people who don't like cities and dislike the concept of democracy, they complain that these agoras mix religious and sacrilegious life, commerce, and politics. They didn't like that, but many more people found that attractive and significant.
He also talks about the square as an organism, that it's not just architecture.
Yes, he does, as do several writers. And what I think is very important there is that the square is not about the architecture. I think that architecture can certainly enhance the square. It's important. But the architecture is there to serve the people who come. It's a backdrop for the people, and the people form the square. Mm-hmm. David Ajay, who's a highly successful architect, is the only architect who wrote for the book. Everybody else was a writer. And he described it, which I found very interesting, the fact that he sees a square in this way rather than a place of architecture.
That it's an organism, that it's a place.
That it's an organism. Right. And he even says that it's not the space itself that's meaningful. It's the way the space facilitates diversity, interaction, and new negotiations. That's a quote that makes it meaningful.
Yeah. And also the distinction from a park, although there are some squares that have parks in them or, maybe park-like, but that there's a basic distinction between a park, which is where you go to retreat, and a square where you come to be together.
Michael Kivelman points that out in his introduction, and since I've always loved city parks, and I did my first book, in fact, on city parks, I was particularly intrigued by that concept, and I think it's true. He refers, in fact, to one specific example of the Madison Square Park and Square area. So I went there one day, and I walked through the park, which is not a large park. It's about two blocks long, two blocks wide, but it's beautiful. It's full of trees. It's full of paths. It has a small playground. People are walking their dogs. They're walking alone. And there is an immediate sense of calm that comes over you. And then I went outside and crossed the street to this triangle that's in the middle of two streets where Fifth Avenue and Broadway merge. And it's a complicated intersection for traffic. During the Bloomberg administration, they decided to put tables and chairs out to create a gathering space. And Michael talks about the head of Pentagram, the wonderful graphics design company, who had said to him he couldn't imagine it working. And sure enough, he was surprised that it did work. And when I was there, which was on a cold December afternoon, there were people out there. And I sat down, and in just a minute, you could get the sense of the city and the sense of activity. Just the and a truly a different mood came over me. Now, I was looking for it, but it was there. And I found that a wonderful example of the difference between the two.
Yes, and there's also just not too far south of that, one of my favorite squares, and that's Union Square, which also kind of combines a park. You know, I'd say a lot of people eat their lunch in the park-like part of it, but then there's this open space in the front of it that fronts on 14th Street, which is an incredible gathering spot.
Yes, and I looked up Union Square. I learned a bit about Union Square. It was created in the mid-1800s, and it was created and modeled, really, after the residential squares of London, which, incidentally, were modeled after Place des Vosges, which was the first planned square in Paris. So to me, it's interesting. I cover all of the different places, but how they merge. And then it wasn't terribly satisfactory in its design, so Olmsted actually got in. He's a legendary landscape designer who designed Central Park and Prospect Park and many parks, I've realized, and places, public spaces around the country in the late 1800s. And it became really the place for public gatherings. And particularly the labor movement took it on, and more left-wing causes. And the first Labor Day parade in New York City was held in Union Square. And what moved me most of all was after 9/11. And George Packer talks about this in his essay about the history of the square. After 9/11, Union Square was the closest big public space. And people somehow went there. They gravitated to be there. And they brought candles. They brought flowers. They brought messages to loved ones. They wrote in chalk on the concrete, which, as you know, is there, as you described. And everyone came together. Now, no one knew each other, but obviously they shared this immense sadness, and they were moved to be together. And that square provided that for them.
Yes, I remember that. It was a very powerful experience. And then even moving south on on Fifth Avenue, before we leave New York, we can talk about Washington Square Park, which recently was the site of some, perhaps more than 30,000 people who went to see Bernie Sanders. I live not too far from there, and the blocks all the way around were an absolute crush. Everyone was streaming to that square. Talk a little bit about Washington Square.
I live not far from that area either when I was in my 20s and walked to work on Wall Street through that square very early in the morning, and it was generally empty. And I didn't think about it at the time. And some people would consider that more of a square, and some people would consider it more of a park. Mm-hmm. Personally, I would consider it more of a square. And as you say, it performed one great example of why squares are important when Bernie Sanders and that had that huge rally and thousands of people came. But to me, it really is a hybrid because it has both squares, square qualities, and park qualities. I'm very involved in the High Line, which has become a hugely successful public park. And we think of ourselves as a park. We also think of ourselves as a cultural organization. But when I was talking to the founder and executive director, Robert Hammond, about it, we mused about the fact that people come to be with each other. They come to see each other. They really come often to watch other people, as Michael calls it, watch stuff happen. And in that sense, it has some square qualities. So there are clearly these spaces around the world, two right there, not very far from each other in New York City, which are hybrids between a square and a park.
Right, right. And so also a place, that was a political event very much in this book, City Squares, that you have edited and put together, Katie Marin, is the concept of the square as an area, an arena of political confrontation. There are marvelous essays about Tahrir Square, Tiananmen Square, I don't know how to pronounce the Wenceslas Square in Prague.
Is that is that right? It is right.
Okay, that brought Václav Havel to head the nation. Even mention of Red Square. I didn't know this, that during Perestroika, there was actually a huge a political demonstration when people, much to the surprise of the leaders that were standing in the, the viewing stand, showed signs that criticized the regime. So talk about the square as an arena of political confrontation.
In fact, that's how I first came up with the idea for the book, because of the square's importance in geopolitics. And one time I was in Rome, and there are, of course, beautiful squares there. To me, I think of Italy is sort of the mother country of squares. They're everywhere. And so we were around, walking around, and you'd always bump into squares. And at the same time, the huge crisis was going on in the Euromaidan, which is in Kiev, Ukraine, and that was a massive movement at the time, the Ukrainians fighting back against the Russians. So it hit me suddenly that that had happened, Tahrir Square, the uprising in Cairo that you just mentioned had occurred, Taksim Square, the protest that the people started, in fact, against the government because Erdogan wanted to there was a mini park, which, again, we're talking about hybrids, a mini park, small park, within Taksim Square. And he wanted to demolish most of that park to create a shopping mall. And the people wouldn't have it. So they went in for that specific reason. And over time, over a very short period of time, a week or less than a week, masses of people piled into the square and the streets surrounding it to protest against the government generally. So I thought of those places, and I'd been in Taksim Square. I'd realized just a couple of months before the protest, when it was a very calm, interesting, nice, busy square. And it hit me that in the last 5 years, these protests had all occurred and how important the square was. So that is really important. And I've learned over time that many squares, you mentioned Red Square, Tiananmen Square, have been imposed by state powers for state occasions to represent the grandiose, the idealized quality of a nation. And as David Remnick says, authoritarians don't realize how dangerous it is to have a city square. I thought that was a wonderful quote because it's true. They're going in to do it for their own purposes, to represent their own grandeur. And in fact, it can be used and will be used, as you mentioned, in Red Square for people's protests.
Right. And that Taksim Square is in Turkey, we should say, in Istanbul. And what strikes me is, you know, as you say, in the past 5 years, I mean, Tiananmen Square was earlier, but these are really modern movements, you know, and there's almost a counter image to this in, I thought, a very moving discussion of Rabin Square by Ari Shavit. This was a place in Tel Aviv. It's the major square of the nation. It's where Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. The title of that essay is So Empty, So Loud. Talk a little bit about his view of the square. I mean, there's a real kind of melancholy about it.
Yes, I totally agree. And Ari and his wife, Timna, have become friends of mine through doing this book, which was a lovely extra benefit of doing this. And he wrote a wonderful book called My Promised Land about Israel. And he has very strong feelings about Tel Aviv. Everyone talks about Tel Aviv being this incredibly vibrant, exciting city. People are just full of life there. I'm sure they're always living on the edge, and that just makes them even more energetic. But this square, which was designed in the 1960s for rallies, generally stays empty. And yet all around it, it will be busy, but people don't go through the square. And there's something inhuman about it. It wasn't well designed. So in that sense, it argues that architecture is very important. And it was years ago used more often, but as you said, Rabin was assassinated there. And we actually have a picture, a photograph of the rally that was occurring that night before he was assassinated. And balloons are going up, and it's full of color. And then you think what happened minutes later. It's stark and in contrast. And over time, it's just an unwanted space. So he writes about that very openly.
Yeah.
It doesn't pretend that it's a highly successful square. It's not.
Right. He says the square became central to our lives just as our political system became dysfunctional, which I thought was interesting. And the other thing is just to contrast that to a square in the occupied territory. Now, I didn't put it in my notes, so I can't remember where it is, maybe in Gaza, but where there was the attempt to create a square, but people didn't want it because they felt that it would stamp their settlement, I guess it was a square and a settlement, as being somehow permanent, and they want to go back to where they were thrown out of in Palestine.
Actually, in that case, I think if I have the one you're referring to, and then we could maybe talk about Kabul, because that's a case where the culture wouldn't accept it, which I found fascinating. But yes, you're right. People did not want that square. And there was a huge rebellion. It was a refugee camp. People felt like they were living in temporary space. There was nowhere for them to come together. An architect decided this would be a great thing for the people to have. And she went on a lobbying campaign, basically, first with the women. But the women were afraid that if they agreed over time, you know, the men would just dominate the square. And what they did in the end was put up a wall on the side so it was protected. And you had a feeling of security from the protection, and yet you had open space. And from what Michael Kimmelman says, who writes about this, it's very successful now, and it is a place which is used as a square, just like a square would have been used 1,000 years ago, where people come to get, they come to get married, they come to socialize, they come to negotiate, where children come to play. And one woman was writing about it, or talking about it, and she said, basically, this is where we feel free. Her quote exactly is, here in the public square, we feel free. And I thought that was a very moving quote.
Yeah, that is beautiful.
And concept.
Right. And now, yeah, talk about the essay by Rory Stewart. He wrote The Great Game, which is a book about Afghanistan. A square called Maidan in Kabul. The square resisted, I think, is the title of that. And you actually start the book with that. It's so interesting what happens. I mean, here this do-gooder comes in to create this wonderful space. And then what happens?
Yeah, I just found it fascinating. Rory Stewart's also an incredibly fascinating man. As you mentioned, he's had a couple of books, and he walked across Afghanistan by himself years ago when it was a safer country, and then he wrote about it. He's a really intrepid explorer. He fell in love with Kabul. He moved to Kabul. He wanted to help the citizens of Kabul. So he really wanted to create an area for them where there was a community center, where there were libraries, ultimately a medical facility. And he took this one area and was forming a square. He planted trees. He opened the space. He landscaped it. And he's watched then, for instance, they'd say, well, we need this building, but we want to move it here. And we actually really want to move that school there. And he's watched all of these important institutions move away from the square, and in front of his own eyes, in the course of a decade, he is seeing this square disappear. And he writes about its history a bit. And twice in the last 300 years, other men have tried to create a square for their specific reasons. And again, the culture there didn't like it. They like these winding, narrow streets. They want this sense of privacy, and they don't feel comfortable out in the open with other people. So in that sense, the people are really refusing the square.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Katie Marin. The book she edited is called City Squares, and it's a collection of essays by a number of wonderful writers about squares throughout the world. So moving back to Europe now, again, and France, I loved the essay by Adam Gopnik. He writes about the Place des Vosges in Paris. He says it's a supreme public place that feels private. And he very much talks about the layers of history. He says it's a melancholy place because history is a melancholy thing. What do you think he meant by that?
He does take that point of view, and it is interesting. That, by the way, is the only actually physical square. It is actually square, and I think one reason it's known to be so beautiful is because it's designed in such a symmetrical way. All the buildings are the same height. They're all the same. They were at the time used for the same purpose. There are trees in the center. There's grass. There's shade. He points out that in Paris, there's very little shade. But there in Place des Vosges, you have that. You also have the alleys, and then you have the cafes off the alleys. So it's been a hugely successful square, though it, too, has gone through its downturn. And then, you know, then again had its upturn. As far as layers of history, what I think he means is that we feel history in certain places. Mm-hmm. I started to think about the concept, and I thought that there are certain places, you mentioned Tiananmen earlier, for instance, or Red Square. We know about the history there. You know about it from history books, all sorts of books, or whatever. Yet there are other places, smaller scale places, where you feel it. And he picks up the melancholy. I think that's personal. I've never talked to him about it, even though I do know him and I really should talk to him about it. But at the same time, it's funny, now that we're talking about it, you and I are talking about it, I often feel like Paris itself has a somewhat melancholy feeling. Mm. And I felt that on other trips there. I love it. I would go back many a time. But there is a melancholy to it, and I don't really know from where that came, but to me it's that feeling and how different that is from knowing something.
Yeah, and certainly amazing layers of history. I mean, there's the Place de la Concorde, which has a revolutionary history. And, you know, I almost wonder as you're talking if it has something to do with the light, because Paris has a very kind of opalescent gray kind of shimmering cast to its light, which is both beautiful and possibly is part of that melancholy.
It's funny you say that, because that's what I love most about it. And one time we were there, and there were two really rainy, sort of nasty days. And the next morning I woke up and it was crystal clear. And the entire day was the most beautiful light I've ever seen in my life. And I would do anything if I knew that one of those days was coming to go over there and see it. It was amazing. But I know exactly what you mean. The clouds hang low, and there's almost a haunting quality to it, a rather mystical quality, I think. And you're right, maybe it's the melancholy.
Mm.
And maybe, again, it's the culture, you know, and the way people think. I don't know. There's something there.
Yeah. And talking about history, another wonderful square that's talked about in an essay is the square in Marrakesh. Who wrote that essay now?
That's the one by David Adjaye, who is the
architect,
who is, in fact, doing the African-American Museum, the African-American branch of the Smithsonian that should be opening this September.
Oh, that's great.
He's fantastic. And I thought he wrote beautifully, too. As an architect, he still wrote beautifully.
Yeah.
And I loved, I've been there. I haven't been to all of these squares. I'd say maybe I've been to a third, probably a little bit less. But I loved many aspects of that essay. I was fascinated by what he called the seamless dance of activity over the day, with the juice vendors arriving very early, then all sorts of household good merchants, then in the afternoon the snake charmers, the henna painters, the fortune tellers coming in to attract the tourists. Then they pack up, and a whole new group of entertainers come in the evening, the dancers, the musicians, storytellers, other food vendors. And then at the end of the night, they pack up. And this entire, what he calls a temporary village, is reinvented the next day. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, and also when he says it's David Adjaye says that it's a narrative about history, I almost felt like it was a walk through. It was almost time travel, because looking at the photograph there, you have snake charmers, actual snake charmers. I didn't know they still existed in the 21st century, in the 21st century.
Yes, and when we were there, that was a special family trip. They were there, and they were dressed, I think, quite similarly to how they would have been dressed a long time ago. So, again, you had this feeling of history that was right in front of your eyes. in every way you could imagine, being back 100 years. And there were lots of snake charmers in the square. In fact, our daughter has a particularly strong fear of snakes, as some people do, and she absolutely did not want to go there because of the snakes. And we managed to not have her look when we came across a snake charmer, and it worked out fine.
Oh, that's great. And finally, the last essay in the book is about the virtual square. It starts out in a real square for a virtual for a company in virtual space. That's Hacker Square. That's Facebook's Hacker Square. But it really talks about the virtual square, the cyber square. It's author Gillian Tett. I thought it was funny. She talks about her 10-year-old daughter who says that Facebook is for old people. I can say that my 12-year-old granddaughter says the same thing, and they both love Instagram. So talk a little bit about Gillian Tett's essay and how does she see this cyber square?
I, again, found that essay fascinating because, as you say, it starts with a physical square, and there is Facebook's new headquarters, and what do they create but a square for people to come together, and they put a crane inside it, which is a place where people are supposed to go to brainstorm and come up with new ideas. So there is your gathering spot, sort of like the fountain or the statue or who knows what in the middle of the square. Again, proving how important it is to have a physical square. Two facts that I found particularly interesting. One is that younger people, the world isn't as safe as it was when I think you and I grew up. Mm-hmm. And I think younger people, the teenagers, preteens, they have more limits on where they can go. They can't go places as freely. So they tend to stay home. And that social media has brought them together as a square. She said at one point that, of course, they are digital natives in the way we're not, no matter how talented we might be with technology. We didn't grow up with it. And the people who did grow up with it are used to huddling around one iPhone or whatever, and that's forming their own sort of square, which when we use an iPhone, we use it on our own. So I found that also interesting. And you're right, she did talk about her daughters and how they now use the internet the way she would use a square years ago, or also the phone. But what really hit me is that when we were talking about the geopolitical movements that happen in squares, like the Euromaidan, for instance, and Chrystia Freeland talks exactly about this, when a journalist decided, we've had enough, we have to get together, he sent out a message on Facebook. By the time he got to, and he said, come to the square. By the time he got to the square, there were already 50 people there. By the end of the evening, there were over 1,000 people there. Within the course of the next couple of weeks, hundreds of thousands of people were there. And social media told them what was happening or where to come. And in fact, it was called, I think if I write, Europe Independent Square, but it was quickly, well, everyone now knows that square as the Euromaidan. And the Euromaidan is actually hashtag Euromaidan, which is a word that means square in other languages, in several languages. The social media was used, but it directed them to the physical square. And when the people had to make their point, they didn't make it over social media, they made it in the square. And that, to me, is, again, another strong example of how squares have stood the test of time.
Yes, and it is just a fascinating book that you've put together here, Katie Maron, this book, City Squares. I just found it, both the photographs in the book and the essays in the book are absolutely fascinating, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it was my great pleasure. Thank you, Francesca. Thank you very much.
You can read an excerpt from City Squares by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we re-air our 2015 interview with David Kishik about his book, The Manhattan Project. It imagines what the urban culture critic Walter Benjamin might have thought about New York had he been successful in escaping Nazi-occupied Europe for the U.S. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When the German philosopher Walter Benjamin committed suicide on the French-Spanish border in 1940, he left behind one of the most brilliant and idiosyncratic cultural critiques of a city the world has ever known. Unfinished at the time of his death, the Arcades Project was a massive collection of notes about Paris, filled with penetrating insights, fragmentary analyses, and vivid descriptions of the city in which Benjamin spent the last 13 years of his life. Walter Benjamin killed himself in despair on finding the Spanish border temporarily closed when he was trying to flee Nazi-occupied France and make it to New York City, where he had obtained a visa to teach at the New School. But what if he faked his suicide? What if he actually made it to New York? And what if he continued his investigations of urban philosophy by pursuing a Manhattan project, like the Arcades Project about Paris? That's the thesis of David Kishik's book, The Manhattan Project, A Theory of a City. The book is a scholarly study of an imaginary text by Benjamin about New York. An urban philosopher himself, Kishik examines the city through the lens of Benjamin's sensibility. For lovers of New York, Walter Benjamin, Jane Jacobs, and urban philosophy in general, it's a fascinating exploration of Manhattan as the capital city of the 20th century. We spoke with David Kishik in 2015 and re-air the first 20 minutes of that interview here. Well, David Kishik, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca, for having me.
This wonderful book, The Manhattan Project, is a work really of urban philosophy and cultural criticism wrapped in the cloak of a speculative fiction, a kind of disquisition on a work by Walter Benjamin that doesn't exist. Explain.
My idea was, after 2 years of doing research for this book that was basically influenced by the Arcades Project, to write some kind of a book about 20th century Manhattan as the capital of the 20th century, I just couldn't write it for about 2 years. And after I came to think about this basically sort of a postmodern ploy, it became much more easier for me to actually write the book. And the idea was to extend Benjamin's life, who died in 1940 as he was escaping the Nazis on the border between France and Spain on his way to New York. My idea is that he actually made it to the city, and he lived here in New York until 1987. He died when he was actually 95. And while he was living here anonymously, he eventually started going to the public library on 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue, and he began to compose this sequel to the Arcades Project, which he called the Manhattan Project. Now, my book is not his book. My book is essentially just an analysis of that text that was never written.
Yes, and that's a kind of a fascinating meta view, because you're not writing it as Benjamin, and yet you do seem to channel Benjamin. And I pronounce it Benjamin because that's probably how most of our listeners will hear it, but Walter Benjamin. I've read part of the Arcades Project, Paris, the capital of the 19th century. Tell us a little bit about that real book that Benjamin wrote. So tell us a little bit about Walter Benjamin himself and who he was, because while the Arcades Project is well known among a certain circle of people or people of a certain affinity, it's not particularly a mass cultural phenomenon.
It cannot be, because it's not actually a book. It's basically his notes that he made in preparation to that book, that maybe he could have finished it if he actually lived that long. But some people say that it was an impossible project. I think that maybe the way by which I channel him has to do with the way this book is written. So maybe I can say something about that. The book as we have it is based on this distinction into what is called convolutes, basically sheafs of papers that he basically organized according to certain themes, subjects, places, architectonic symbols, all those different themes that compose basically what would have become essentially his book at the end, which is the way basically I also walk. I will read all this secondary literature on New York, and I will organize in this according to very similar essentially themes. And a big part of what I was trying to do in this book was to translate certain elements from his book on Paris to my book on New York.
And you say there are what you call elective affinities that are revealed between the two cities, almost as if, I mean, they are not the same, but one gives rise to the other, and they're in a kind of dialectical relationship.
Precisely. Dialectics is something that is true also within every city in and of itself. Because Benjamin thought about the Arcades Project as essentially a philosophy of modernity, through his analysis of 19th century Paris, he was trying to make sense of what does it mean to live in the modern world. In the same way, I'm trying to basically append or just create some kind of an adjustment to his work by trying to speak of 20th century New York in order to create a different type of what modernity is. So many of his elements will be moved into a different direction. For instance, a theoretical hero of Benjamin's book was Karl Marx, and therefore the book is essentially some kind of a, I wouldn't call it communist, Benjamin was a pretty bad Marxist, people will say. He wasn't in any way a dogmatic one. I am also very much influenced by Marx's work, by an attempt to think about the city in its materiality, but I also move in different directions. And one of the ways by which I move beyond Benjamin is to start talking about Hannah Arendt rather than Marx as my personal hero. Arendt, who lived in New York until her death at the late 70s, basically will create a rather critical attitude towards Marx. And I will follow that critique in order to actually move from a thought about the city as an economic entity, although I will talk about that as well pretty extensively, into a thought about the city as a truly, maybe the true political entity.
You, in fact, say that the modern city, the city of the 20th century, New York as its apotheosis, I guess, is a place where you call it the Ecopolis, or the Ecopolis. I'm not sure how you would pronounce that, but a place where the economy and politics are interpenetrated. Could you explain what you mean by that, and how is that different, say, than Berlin or London or, cities of past centuries?
Ecopolis is very much based on Arendt's work. The thought for Arendt was that Athens is divided. The Athenians divided their lives, basically. They lived a rather split life between the home and the city, between the oikos and the polis. In the oikos, they will live this life that they actually called zoe. They had a special word for life in the household. And that life will be based on essentially economic necessities. And what she means, what the Greeks meant by economy, was anything that had to do with the household, including sleeping, eating, work, and the money that you can get out of it was just a part of that. The way they will treat their kids, the way they will treat their slaves was all a part of the oikos, as well as having sex. All of the biological necessities of life. The polis was a completely different place for them. When they left the darkness of the oikos and moved into the light of the public sphere, into the polis, into politics, their life transformed from the fact of life to the form of life, to the meaning of life. And that is what the city was about. It was a space where you will speak and act in public. Arendt believes that that separation is lost in modernity. And I follow her work in that sense, that I no longer think that we separate the home from the city. This is something that perhaps already began to unravel in 19th century Paris. Benjamin will talk about the flâneur, the one who will walk around the streets of Paris, treating the street as if it was his personal living room. So you can see how the outside begins to be an inside and an inside begins to be an outside. But I do think that that movement really got into its full manifestation in 20th century New York, where we can no longer distinguish between what is public and what is private. And therefore, I think that the only way we could really make sense of our lives today is to imagine that new space that I call an acropolis.
Could you give us an example of what you're talking about?
There are all these funny quotes that I would find in like old New Yorker magazines where people will say that home is the place you go as a last resort, or where you go to change, basically. In opposition to Paris, where people would treat the outside, and even today you can think about that. You could walk in the streets of Paris and think about the street as if it was a private space. In New York, it seems as if the opposite is the case. It seems to me, specifically when you go to lofts in 70s, 60s sort of like way of thinking, that those spaces feel sometimes as if they are streets. And for me, it seems as if in New York, you will have that flip of the Parisian situation where the inside will feel a little bit like an outside rather than the other way around.
Well, we are sitting right now doing this interview in one of those lofts, one of the artist lofts of the 1970s, which is still a building like that, which also itself expresses that it can be given as an example. Half of the space is what my mother, because this was her place, she called her living space, and the other half of the space is a public performance space. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, for sure. I had the opportunity to go to the Judd house a few months ago, and even the entrance that is in a way a public space, you could have looked into that space for many, many years before they actually opened the museum, is also a private space. And that for me is even more powerful because here we still need to get through the buzzer and get upstairs, etc. But that will be a space that will be basically on street level with all these windows, and that will be where they will walk and hang out, present works of art, but it still was his own private home.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Kishik. His book is The Manhattan Project. One of the things that I really was attracted to in the book was your notion of the street. Walter Benjamin talked about the Paris arcade. Could you contrast the arcade of 19th century Paris to the street of 20th century New York?
I think that the idea to build basically some kind of a quasi-private, quasi-public space, as the arcade was, turned into a rather nightmarish condition. And Benjamin was very much well aware of it. He noticed how those arcades that at the beginning when they just opened were, you know, the coolest places where the cream of society used to visit, turned very easily and very swiftly into those places that were only visited by, let's say, prostitutes and weird people. And that is exactly what attracted the surrealist into those spaces, which is basically why Benjamin will be interested in this as well, because of them. The idea for Benjamin is that once you turn a public space, like a street, into a private space, like an arcade, privacy somehow leads to a kind of a fantasy. The fantasy, the dream, he will talk about Paris as a phantasmagoria. And then, very easily, the dream turns into a kind of a nightmare. Now, I think that every private space eventually runs down, whereof public space, a street like Broadway around here, will always remain vital, no matter what is happening, what stores come in and out, it will always remain almost eternal. If there is a sense of eternity in the city, I think it is expressed best in the emptiness of the street, in this canals of voidish air, as David Denneby used to say, I think, in one of his poems. So my idea is basically that the arcade, which turned into the department store, that turned into the mall, never had a true foothold in Manhattan in the 20th century. Yes, we had and still have remnants of department stores. However, we never had a really functional mall in the city. Even the one that we have right now, and it's kind of functional, the one in Columbus Square, has these huge windows into the square to give a sense that this is just another store window. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, New Yorkers don't want to be in this indoor space. They much prefer the outside, even though it's not air conditioned, etc. So I think that in 20th century New York, the public street still wins over what anywhere else in America will turn into the death of Main Street and the rise of the mall. But again, the weird thing is that every mall in America has a certain kind of a lifespan, a very short lifespan, that very easily the beautiful mall of yesterday becomes this weird place that no one wants to visit the day after.
Well, it's interesting when you say that. And first, I want to say that when you say the empty street, you don't mean a street empty of people. You mean a street that can be eternal. You know, Broadway has been around since this was founded as a colony in New Amsterdam.
Since the 1811 commissioner's plan to lay down the grid of Manhattan, Broadway was already set essentially in stone. Those streets, this grid, became that unchangeable element in the city. We could change these buildings. Actually, here it's not so easy because since the 50s and the 60s, they are protected. But for me, the street is essentially what I call non-architecture. It is empty because it is not the built form. It is the space of what I will call either lived form or what I eventually call sheer life.
This book that you're analyzing, this fictional book of Walter Benjamin's, The Manhattan Project, that you're analyzing in this book, it takes place, is written during a time of crisis in New York City. A different crisis, almost the polar opposite of the crisis that is happening now. Then was a time when the city's monetary values, its exchange value of its buildings was going down. That's why Soho, in fact, could be a place for artists. It was incredibly cheap. Now it's a place where ordinary people are being moved out of neighborhoods. So I wanted to ask you, you talk about sheer life. What happens to sheer life in a gentrifying city, and how do you construct that within the context of your book?
It is a difficult subject. I think that on the one hand, we used to sigh at the reliction of the city. Now we sigh at its revitalization in a way. I think it's a pretty established fact that when the cranes are silent, the muses are having a ball, basically. And that is what happened in mid-20th century Manhattan. Could it still happen today? Increasingly, it is becoming very, very, very difficult. I think, though, any time a person that lives in New York may be of any kind of a faith, but the first deity that you need to worship is called the deity of the real estate, the landlord, essentially. Whatever it is that is your agenda, whether you're an artist or work in finance, the biggest chunk of your paycheck is always going to go to Moloch, essentially, what Allen Ginsberg will see as this menacing force over the city. Yes, we do talk a lot, urban thinkers talk about the right to the city. Who has a right to the city these days? However, I believe that the very question of right is a question that has to do with sovereign states rather than with urban spaces. It is the state that gives and takes rights away. Cities actually don't have that power within their jurisdiction. So the right to the city, I'm wondering what can really be done about this. One of the things, the last things I remember that Jane Jacobs said once when someone asked her, what can we do with Soho? Because it used to be a great place. She had a great hand in making it still viable rather than a place through which a highway will pass. And she already saw how both Soho and her old neighborhood, Greenwich Village, will transform into a space of luxury living. And her answer was actually unpredictable. She said, when a neighborhood is boring, even the rich people leave, get out of there, basically. I don't think that it was in her philosophical way of thinking about the city, a place to actually feel that kind of like, oh, what can we do with these neighborhoods? You move someplace else and you try it there. I don't necessarily think that there is much to be done, unfortunately.
Hmm. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Kishik. He's a philosopher, an urban philosopher, and his book is The Manhattan Project. You talk about New York City as the Archimedean point, the kind of the fulcrum from which the rest of the world moves. What do you mean by that?
The question is not really about the centralization of power, but of what Benjamin will call, or what we can call, a paradigm, a place that if you make some kind of a sense of, you could make sense of something that is much grander than itself. Again, what we will basically think about as modernity as such.
It seems like a lot of what you're talking about in this book boils down to what makes a city a place where human beings can actually live.
Yes, that's essentially what I call sheer life. The city for Benjamin is a landscape built of sheer life. I think that the biggest mistake that we can make is to think about cities in general, and New York in particular, as some kind of a built form. I want to think about it as a lived form. Architecture is exactly what, even though this will be our knee-jerk reaction when we think about, oh, what is New York? You see a big building. In reality, I think that that notion is a way to distract us from what the city really is. I feel that every time that even I look at a building in New York as I walk by, I feel a little bit, teeny bit like a tourist still, because the insider in a way is the one that is no longer so much interested necessarily in the architecture. For me, the city is a landscape built of sheer life. And that is what I'm really interested, basically. What is that urban form of life? What does it mean to live a modern life, given the fact that it necessarily means to live an urban life?
David Kishik, talking about his book, The Manhattan Project. We spoke with him in 2015. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the extended interview. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.